welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We'll continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. When I was a young lad, coming up, as they say, in New York City, I began to give talks at the New York Open Center, which was kind of a, let's say it was a center for spiritual workshops and retreats, and they had a lively, unusually lively public lecture series that was programmed by a fellow who's also been on Expanding Mind, J.P. Arpigny, and he had an unusually rich kind of view of the ways in which spirituality and religious questions folded into other political and cultural sides and dimensions of life, and kind of brought me in under that aegis. And one of the great things about giving talks at the Open Center in that period of time was I got to meet our guest today, Peter Lamborn Wilson, who should be well known to many of our listeners here on Expanding Mind, as he covers or sort of occupies a somewhat similar space of interest in spirituality, spiritual experience, but how it links to politics, to poetry, to drugs, to history, and really using that these questions, this hunt for the religious imagination and its origins, both in the human soul and in concrete historical conditions, as a really good way to peer into the interstices of our society, those hidden places where currents of alternate possibility and sometimes devastating perceptions on the mainstream exist. And so I learned a lot from going to Peter's talks, because he covered such a wide range and has covered such a wide range of material throughout his career, from Sufism to piracy, to the history of pirates, to utopian movements in the 19th century, to Taoist linguistics, on and on and on. Fascinating range of material that was itself very inspiring for me. But also what was inspiring was Peter's model for intellectual production, where he, on the one hand, was avoiding the academy, which I cannot say that I have altogether done for various reasons that maybe we'll talk about, but that he created a very rich, very intellectually coherent mode of doing history and thinking about culture and thinking about the meanings of these various things outside of the strictures of scholarship, but at the same time not dumbing down the message or pandering to popular movements as a way to gain celebrity or have some kind of particular cultural identification. So he really became a model for me of a kind of outsider scholarship that I think is incredibly important and was inspiring to me and a lot of other people. So I'm really happy, both in terms of the form and the content, to have encountered Peter. He's been a really important person in my own intellectual development, and hence in a lot of the topics and approaches that we have on the show and that I've pursued in my writing. So this should be a fun conversation. Before we bring Peter on, bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hey, Eric.
I bet you read a number of Peter Wilson's works. Have you checked out Sacred Drift? Did you ever read that one?
I haven't read that one. No. What's that one about?
Oh, it's a collection of essays that the reason I kind of brought it up is there's something about that, the title alone, and the ideas that are associated with that we're hopefully we'll get into. About the sort of the spirituality of nomadism, or of a kind of following the imagination rather than following the strictly literal fact.
It's interesting too, because I was doing a lot of research on gypsies lately, just, you know, trying to find information on them, and the idea of spiritual nomadism is often seen as a threat. You know, like there's this idea that you have to be this or you have to be that. You can't, and if someone is kind of drifty or not very like particular with exactly what their spirituality is, or if it's not a big accepted one, then it tends to be frowned upon or, you know, looked down upon, when ironically enough the majority of starters of the traditional religions or messiahs are these kind of bum like dudes that just travel all over the place, right? Like Buddha being a perfect example of that. So that's I think that's an important concept for people to look at.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of phrasing it. Well, with that, let's bring on Peter to the show. Peter, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you're in upstate New York?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's lovely. I always like to know where folks are physically coming from. But we've already sort of launched into this this topic of spiritual nomadism, and particularly the relationship between that mode, or the modes we might think about in those terms, and the state form, you know, the way in which our last 6,000 years here on this planet have been increasingly dominated by this sort of very peculiar institution that kind of emerged at some point in history, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years after human beings had been cruising around doing their own thing. So I'm wondering if you could flesh this out a little bit about what is a spiritual nomad? What is spiritual nomadism?
Well, a key word for me is vague. Of course, it's related to vagrant and vagrancy, but, you know, it means a state of creative uncertainty. And to me, the enemy is precision, efficiency, expertise, certainty, rationalism, the cruel instrumentality of reason, as some German philosopher put it. And the antidote, or the complement, if you like, would be vagueness. I'm thinking about this right now in terms of time, the measurement of time. About the calendar, how we suffer from this idea that the calendar must be ever more efficient and mechanically correct. You've been in Boulder, haven't you? Have you seen the clock?
No.
The official atomic clock in Boulder that is based on the decay of the cesium atom. Do you know this?
No.
This is our official time is now based on atomic decay. If you could look for the most unsacred, most unspiritual way of measuring time, I should think that would be it.
I'm now
propagandizing for a return to some earlier, more vague and less efficient calendar.
It's really remarkable when we learn about how the construct of time has changed over the years. The fact that you know, barely over a century ago, in the late 19th century, the towns all across, you know, the United States would, noon was when the sun was highest in the sky,
and if that's right,
you know, and
time 200 miles
in another direction, they had a little bit different noon.
Yeah, time zones are the Industrial Revolution at work, you know, to make things work, to make so trains could arrive at point X, you know, 5 minutes later than they left point Y, instead of like 2 minutes earlier. Time zones, daylight savings time, all this kind of stuff is like the state meddling in organic time to mechanize it, rationalize it, to make it work in terms of work above all. Of mechanized labor.
Yeah, and now we're sort of aligning it also with the sort of the digital pulse of time. And when you were talking about who the enemies are, the you know, efficiency and productivity and these sort of industrial values associated with the state that we internalize, And, you know, if we have projects to get done in our home, you know, there's some of that is a good thing to do. But the pervasiveness and the lack of questioning of these values as they are increasingly, as if it wasn't already bad enough, increasingly sort of forced into the minute fabric of daily life is really extraordinary. And what I was particularly thinking of is this whole fad that's been, you know, more than a fad, it's this whole dimension of contemporary life where people, in response to the confusion and complexity and stress of our, you know, modern urban lives, develop this sort of fetish for efficiency and time management. So it's all about these very clever ways of using to-do lists and reminders and folders and files and, you know, internet programs and apps in order to render your every movement efficient and crystalline.
And this is something that both, you know, reactionaries and liberals agree on, that everything must be more efficient. So it's been a problem on the left historically, is the obsession with progress and industrial efficiency. And well, I think it's only since the 1980s that politically we've, in general, have come to understand that that this is a form of oppression. Well, I don't know. Maybe certain geniuses have understood it for 6,000 years. But socially, I think the bad news has sunk in, and yet at the same time, it's repressed.
Yeah.
Well,
we don't allow ourselves to think these things.
Well, yeah, because the geniuses are usually the vagrants that don't work, right? The ones that come up with all the great ideas that fuel the industry, that come up with the machines or come up with these concepts. They're like, you know, they wander around and figure it out, and that's the only way you can. If you're in the machine, you can't, like, make the industry.
It's very brutally simple. If you have to expand your work, your energy, your creativity for somebody else's profit, you don't have the time to actually think, to contemplate.
Hmm.
It's very simple, you know. And since everybody is a wage slave, we don't allow ourselves to have these thoughts. Because if we did, we would despair utterly. And in fact, we do despair utterly, and that's why 50% of Americans are on antidepressants.
How have you, in your own life, or you know, looking at other people who are engaging these you know, questions with creativity and passion and open eyes? How do people take on this sort of this construct of time that's crammed down our throats? I mean, what are the ways in which, even if it's only for a moment, even if it's only a rear guard action, that people you know, create other kinds of time in their lives or make room for it?
Well, you know, the American educational system historically is based on Prussian education. Do you know this?
Yes.
John Dewey was a big admirer of the Prussian system. And that's what we've got. We have a militarized time crammed down your throats from nursery school on.
Hmm.
You know, it's very simple. It's education means socialization for capitalism. Nowadays, you don't even learn to be a producer. You learn to be a consumer. Basically, it's, you know, the old anarchist slogan, work, consume, die. That's it. That's education. That's what. If you like school, you'll love work. You know, that's the way it works.
When did you leave the schooling system?
I dropped out of Columbia after my halfway into my second year.
Was it as much for the strictures of the university system, or was it because the alternates at that time in history, as I know,
both
were
yeah.
rather tantalizing?
Right. Yes, rather alluring. But no, they were wasting my time.
Yeah.
You know, I realized I could. I was drifting into becoming an English major. I couldn't. I can't imagine anything stupider. You know, you have to pay money to read books under somebody who knows necessarily no more or less than you about what you're reading. This is a total waste of time. I could read the books on my own. I could get them for free from the library and read them. You know.
Well,
and at the same time, it was 1964.
Best
time in the world.
Flashbacks?
What?
Did you get flack for that? For drugs? Like, have people, you know, given you criticism for it, or is everybody kind of cool with it?
Well, you know, I mean, I've never had any trouble about it. But as I say, you know, my smart move was to inherit a little bit of money, so I was independently poor. And as a result, I haven't had to work for somebody else all my life. And this is, you know, I thank the gods and goddesses every day for this. This is my luck. The reason why I'm a radical is because I wish everybody could live that way. And I think everybody could, you know, ideally.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, not to spend a lot of time in ancient history, but I do think it's one of the things that...
That's where I'm spending my time.
is the travels you did. You did, you know, you spent, you know, well, around a decade on the road at this very rich, very interesting time in world history, in the changing shape of countries, of exotic countries, countries that people hadn't really been exploring too much, and, you know, in India and Indonesia and North Africa, and you really cruised around and enjoyed many of the spiritual and other opportunities these places had. And part of what I've learned from reading your books is a sort of deep appreciation for the possibilities of travel, not just even in the literal sense of, you know, having a life-changing time or having true encounters, but the way in which that kind of travel itself becomes a model for how to think, how to be in the world, how to move through all of your experiences. So I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit on, like, on the challenges and the rewards of true traveling, you know, as you have experienced and talked about it.
Well, you know, I have to say recently I've come to question whether travel is possible anymore. I happen, as you say, I happen to have done it at a very interesting moment, which I would define in some ways as before the worldwide information technology revolution, so-called. In other words, where I went, there were no TVs yet, much less computers. And this was a different world. There was also no American imperialism, or at least not so you'd notice it unless you went to Vietnam, I suppose. People were not angry at Americans for being ugly, you know, crypto-imperialists the way they are now. So one was welcome everywhere. And the roads were open. You could go across Asia on foot if you wanted to. I did it on buses mostly. Afghanistan was open, so you could go all the way. And that's what we hippies did. We went from Europe to India on the hippie trail. And it's now closed, effectively. I mean, I suppose if you were really brave, willing to risk your life, you could do it. But in the 70s, it was easy, 60s and 70s. Allen Ginsberg showed the way, and we all followed, you know. And I don't know if you can do that anymore, not just because of Afghanistan, but because of the fact that suddenly everywhere in the world you go, there are cell phones. It makes a big difference, I feel. It changes things. I don't know. Perhaps I shouldn't say this because, you know, I haven't been in India for, what, 20 years, 30 years. Maybe, you know, eternal India is still there. If you know how to travel, you could find it. So I hope, but I have severe doubts.
So what is it that is, in terms of one's growth as a spirit, as an intellect, as someone trying to make their way through the world, what is it that true travel, which may be more difficult these days, but in the way that you've experienced it, what does it open up? What does it allow for?
True travel allows for everything that tourism doesn't. Tourism is the opposite of travel. Real travel is more like pilgrimage. You go to a place because it's holy. You bring your offerings, whatever they may be, even if it's only just your imagination. And you take away spiritual bounty. You learn something. You get knowledge. Tourism is the opposite of all that. You go someplace and you take. You don't give anything in return. And what you take is what you end up taking, basically, is the image. The image of the place. You're not really there. This is why I gave up photography, by the way. Because I felt that when you're photographing something, you're not really there. You're in the camera. Or you're not in the place. You're looking for the image and not for the experience. Maybe other people don't have this problem. Maybe this is just my stupidity. But I think that to travel means essentially to live in other places and to acquire, at least to a certain degree, the point of view outside yourself, you know, the Archimedean position, as it were, from which you later on can move your personal universe. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, for me, one of the things I also got from your work that was really important to me, because I came of age at a time when people were very critical and skeptical about the romance that's associated with a lot of travel, with the history of Europeans and encountering other people. You know, Edward Said's famous argument around Orientalism, and and you showed me a way to, while remaining aware of the importance of those critiques and of not falling into simplistic imperialist imaginaries, that there was a whole other dimension that was not being talked about that had to do precisely with a kind of desire, with a kind of imaginative encounter, with a kind of like mutual fantasizing that can happen in these situations that we see not only in true travel, but also I think in the history of the religious imagination, and particularly the way that different religions encounter one another.
To deny this possibility is to deny the universal human experience of guest-host relations, if you know what I mean. It's to say that contact between cultures is not possible because it's always going to be a power relation. And this is exactly what the hippie traveler, if I can put capital letters on that phrase, was trying to overcome. And if we were wrong in many respects, well, that was a historical period that we went through. But if there was romanticism, believe me, it was not only on our side. The East is full of romantics, as it happens, you know. And there was a meeting of romanticisms, and that was, what, the 60s and 70s, on the hippie trail, or the traveler's trail. That's what it was about, I think, for me anyway.
Well, I don't want to be a party pooper, but I can't help but think of that movie, Naked Prey. I don't know if you saw it.
I'm sorry. No.
Oh, man, the whole movie, it's fantastic. And I think it was done in the 60s, but this guy, an Englishman, like, goes to Africa on safari, and everything's cool. And they're, like you said, they're tourists, you know, and they're there, and they get all captured by this violent tribe that lives there, you know, and the main guy is forced to just, like, run. It's kind of like the most dangerous game. They just set him free and then hunt him for, like, the rest of the movie is just him actually living in Africa instead of being this safari tourist.
This is a new movie?
This was, like, from the 60s. It's fabulous.
Well, it sounds like more crypto-imperialism to me.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, that is, to me, it just stands as a testament to the things that you're talking about, how we, if we really had to live in these places the way that, you know, the people live there, we wouldn't know what to do. We'd just get eaten alive, you know.
But the violence and otherness of other societies is also an imperialist dream, fantasy.
Right.
You know, it's what Said was talking about. You project all your bad thoughts onto the other. And turn them into savages. When you get to know people, people are people everywhere. Yeah. That's one thing I discovered. They're not savages, you know. Muslims, for example, are not by and large, or at least when I knew them, they weren't dreaming of slitting everybody's throats. This is a waste of time. From most human beings, haven't got the time to think about things like this. You know, they're too busy, marrying, getting high, whatever it is they're doing. They're just folks. They have interesting things to teach you that you don't know, but they're basically just folks.
I wanted to ask you, seeing as, you know, I get the sense that One of the things you've done with the sort of collapse of the sense of the possibility of travel is to refocus your interest, your engagement in the place that you actually live, in your locality, in the histories, the hidden histories, the psychogeography, the imaginal and real stories of the area where you are. Was that because I know you moved from New York City, upstate at a certain point. Was that partly out of a desire to be in a locality that actually had natural history as well as
well? I guess so. I mean, New York City has natural history too, after all.
Yeah.
I know someone who's landscaping for a living in New York City. Doesn't that sound weird? But it's perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
There are more beekeepers in Manhattan now, I think, than there are here upstate. Because there's no history of DDT and all those kind of, agricultural pollutants that kill off the bees. So beekeeping in Manhattan has become a fad, not only a fad, but a money-making business from what I hear. So there you go. But yes, I always intended to move to the Hudson Valley. You know why? Did I ever tell you?
No.
It's because I spent time in the 60s at Timothy Leary's place in Millbrook.
Oh, you were at Millbrook.
Yes, I was. And I sort of imprinted on the Hudson Valley, if you know what I mean, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So all the time I was going around the world, and living in New York, I always thought to myself, someday I'll move up the Hudson. And so I did.
Well, I got to, since you brought it up, I must ask, what was your impression of the scene when you were there?
Millbrook?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I always say Leary is a very problematical character, and one could spend a lot of time criticizing him, of course, and people do, but I don't do that, because he was responsible for some of the happiest days of my life. I'm eternally grateful to the madman, He was crazy, but we had a great time.
Well, Are You Serious on the show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah? How's he doing?
He's doing well. He just wrote a short, very... very pleasant, very smart, kind of like a condensed biography of Leary, hitting the high points and really trying to balance out some of the excessive negativity around him. I agree, yeah. He's obviously a very problematic character, but there's a life and an intelligence and an opportunity and a kind of set of permissions that he gave that I think are really, really crucial. Even the way you talked about Leary just in that phrase, it reminded me of something else that you told me once. We were talking about the Iranian Academy, where you did work and research in the mid-70s when you were living in Tehran, and then you kind of made the comment that the place was sort of started by, I can't remember her actual name, but the woman you referred to as Mrs. Shah, and that regime turns out to be a kind of whole, a terrible situation, that you would never say anything bad about Mrs. Shah because you had such a wonderful time in her place.
That's right, and she was a nice lady.
Yeah.
I don't think she's gone.
Yeah.
As far as I know, she's okay. Last I heard, she was living in Connecticut. No, she's a very agreeable person. And when she, she was the second wife of the Shah. He had to get rid of the first wife, who was the related to King Farouk of Egypt.
Right.
Because she couldn't give him children. The rumor was that he didn't divorce her, but he kept her off in a secret palace somewhere and took advantage of Shiite law and married a second wife, who was Farah, and she did give him children. And basically, he married her. When he married her, he said, "Well, dear, you can take care of the women's things like art and charities." And she said, "Okay, I'll do that." And she did. She did a very interesting job of it, and she was extremely generous to a number of poor artists and so forth and so on. Anyway,
great. Well,
I kind of liked her despite all the politics.
Well, what I really liked about this is also just the sense of generosity and of acknowledging the goods that people have brought. It's a reflection of that ghost, that guest host relationship in being sort of appreciating something that even from problematic people can create wonderful opportunities. But we have to take a break right now, so it's a wonderful conversation. We'll be right back. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're speaking with Peter Lamborn Wilson, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking to Peter Lamborn Wilson, and we're talking about just cruising around, having experiences, and living life as you go. And I was curious if you could maybe help. I mean, I know you talked about that while you were with Timothy Leary, you had some of the most amazing experiences of your life. Could you maybe, like, share with us a little, like, example of what you're talking about, like, when you're, you know, really traveling, how that can open up those spaces? Is there any, like, particular ones that would stand for you above the others that were able to unfold in those circumstances that just really struck you?
I don't know. There's so many. I just, as you were speaking, I was remembering an experience that I had when I was in Benares for the first time in India. And I was walking along a street, and there was a street side shrine to Kali. You know Kali?
Mm-hmm.
And there were some drummers there, and there were people. They were doing puja in the evening on the street corner to this little temple. Open-air temple. And I thought to myself, wow, real devil worship at last. It was like a, you know, big revelation. And so I pursued that, and I eventually got myself initiated into Tantra, among all the other things I've done, because of that experience. You know, it was such an aesthetic shock, I guess is the best way to put it, that it opened up new areas of the map. Perhaps
well, and it's
the
true.
Best
like
way.
That, never you never would have done that if you hadn't been standing right there in that moment, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, of course, imagination is strong, and you can get real experiences from books and artworks, but there's nothing quite like the thing itself.
And I feel like that is the majority of people, you know, I mean, in America, certainly not everybody, but there is such a vicariousness, like, that we have all those experiences through internet, through television, through reading. Do you
mediation.
Feel?
They're all mediated. They all become images.
Right.
Images are important because that's the way you use your imagination. But when your
right.
imagination is colonized by other people's images, especially when they're basically aimed at extracting money from you or alienated mm-hmm. labor, then basically this becomes a form of oppression.
Right.
So to me, the entirety of information technology and media, whether mass media or any other media, has to be constantly under the critical eye. You have to constantly be aware of what's being done to you. I call it resistance against image magic. You have
mm-hmm.
to have a counter magic of your own. If you don't, you're just swept away into this maelstrom of mediocrity.
How do you think that's affecting us, like, as a species, like, having all that? Like,
I think it's totally dumbing us down as a species. You know the idea of the futurists talk about the singularity, the moment
right.
when machines will become more intelligent than human beings? Well, in a sense, I think it already happened. Only the machines didn't become more intelligent because that's stupid. That's impossible. Artificial intelligence is a contradiction in terms. What happened was we became stupider. We sank beneath the level of our own technology, and now we're the slaves of the machine. We're serfs.
Mm.
And in our imagination, we're serfs. And this, to me, is unbearable, absolutely unbearable. I can't take it. And that's why I spend all my time in the past. as much as possible these days. So I've been very active in the 5th century AD recently.
Yeah. So what are you researching? I mean, you're always researching something delightful and something I didn't know about before. So what's the current?
I just finished a 400-page draft of a book on one small town in Egypt in the 5th century AD called Panopolis. Which I originally chose it because I thought it would be a total vacation from the 21st century. It turned out to be incredibly important. It's sort of like the origin of Hermeticism is what I got involved in studying, the Egyptian origins of the occult tradition, which happened to be extremely important in this town called Panopolis. So a whole book came out of that.
But that's relatively late. I mean, haven't there already been hermetic currents?
Oh, yeah, sure. But it crystallized there about that time. Because why? Because that was the moment of the final struggle between paganism and Christianity.
It was when Theodosius was killing all the pagans, right? That was like the fall of Alexandria and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, Hypatia, all that stuff. It's all 5th century. Fascinating, terribly dramatic, and not very happy either in a lot of ways.
No.
But extremely colorful and such amazing characters. And Egyptian tradition mixed in with the Greek and the Roman and Mesopotamian, all very syncretistic. Indians are coming to Egypt, and Greeks are visiting India. As I say, the hippie trail is very old. It goes back at least to time of Alexander. And the whole Hellenistic world is just all one. Asia just becomes all one. And the West, as we know it, Greece, Italy, all becomes one great world of syncretistic spirituality. And that's what we have now in the form of theosophy and Freemasonry and so forth and so on. It's all from that period.
In other words,
when you dig back into the past, where do you come to first? Late antiquity, right? So late antiquity is terribly important in the fact that it's ignored, because deep antiquity is actually nicer and more interesting. Is a mistake, because late antiquity is full of fascinating stuff, really fascinating.
Well,
anyway.
it's also much more resonant and relevant to where we are. I mean,
we still live there.
Yeah, I remember when I visited Ostia, which is just outside of Rome, and it's around, you know, 2nd, 3rd century. It was a port town that grew up. And what was so weird is I love ancient archaeology. I go to Neolithic sites. I go to, Paleolithic caves. I love that old stuff. But it was the first time that I've gone to a quote unquote, ancient site, where I'm walking around going, this is totally familiar. I don't even need to look at the guidebook to know that that's where the bar was. It was clear that's where the bar is supposed to be. And the firemen are over here, and here are the whores. And the way the city's laid out, it's like walking through a grid of your own, already established kind of...
I don't know why I never went to Ostia. I lived in Rome for a year, and I never got there.
Yeah. So it was very striking. But one of the things is that you brought up is this... the central importance of Hermeticism, and you mentioned some more modern expressions with Theosophy and Freemasonry. But one of the ways of looking at your own work is that you've extended the Hermetic tradition or the Hermetic imagination into political and particularly environmentalist zones, where it really has a lot to say that's maybe a little bit different than what we see with, say, Freemasonry. So to talk a little bit about the still liberating or the still enriching potentials that are inside the Hermetic tradition, going back to the second, to late antiquity, but being able to flower today in something like the book you did on green Hermeticism.
Let's see. I guess you could say that the problem was, clarified by Nietzsche in his attack on monotheism as a form of body hatred, which becomes a hatred of the earth itself, Now, you might say that, again, in late antiquity, that is the time of crisis, many historians call it, is that where these attitudes come to take over human consciousness in general. And therefore, you have Gnosticism, you have Christianity, you have all these new ideas appearing against the old pagan idea that nature is nature. Naturally, it has gods, but it's also real. It's real because it has gods. You might say, as above, so below, in the words of the famous emerald tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, which certainly has Egyptian origins. So what you have in Hermeticism is the idea of the unity of the material and conscious aspects of being, that through consciousness one is one with nature, and that nature is holy in and of itself. This idea is called into question by Christianity. It's not that nature is completely rejected, as in Gnostic dualism, which really does say that the body is evil, totally. But there's an implication in the Judeo-Christiano-Islamico tradition that the body is inferior, and that the real truth is to be found in the world of the spirit, which has no body, and which is, in fact, you know, when you come right down to it, it's mental. What the Greeks called nous. It's the nousphere. And when you make a split between these two levels, well, splits are always schizophrenic in some way, and this one turned out to be a real disaster for the what we call the environment, a rather fluffy word which is hard to pin down to any real meaning, but anyway, we're stuck with it. What does it mean? Does it mean nature? No, for many people, no. It doesn't mean nature in the sense of the material world as a whole. It means the birds and the bees or something. I don't know. But this is why I don't really like the term. But if we are still or once again in a moment of crisis, this crisis arises from this split that Nietzsche made so clear between the body and the spirit. And the whole point about Hermeticism is to unify those things. That's what alchemy is actually about. It's not purely a spiritual science, and it's not purely a material science. It is precisely the place where these two things come together. And without alchemy, I don't see any possibility for what we call the environmental movement. And that implies a whole politique, naturally. There has to be, this has to have its ramifications on every level of the social, and as well as science. So there has to be a rethinking of science in terms of Hermeticism. And this is not difficult, given that modern science is actually derives from Hermetic science, by turning it on its head, of course. I mean, we're talking about now Newton, Boyle, the Royal Society, the moment at which science is taken away from the seized away from the idea of eternal spiritual wisdom and given over to the idea of nationalism and profit for in a mercantile sense. And,
it's slowly turning back that direction through the physicists, right? I mean, which is funny because Isaac
Newton. Oh, yeah. If you look at modern physics from this point of view, many things would become clear.
Right.
Many problems in cosmology and quantum mechanics and so forth and so on would acquire a new symbolique, you know, a new symbolic value, which is important. Because to say that we live in a dead universe where everything is a result of chance and mechanism, and we live on an insignificant speck of in a corner of a galaxy which is in a process of entropic decline, this is not good for the human soul.
It's like how you talked about the clock at the beginning, that it's based on decay. Everything's run by entropy, that everything is decaying and falling apart, and they're not accounting for the fact that everything's also coming back together at the same time. So that's where the alchemy comes in.
As an anarchist, I'm against the second law of thermodynamics. I want to, repeal it.
What do you pose in either, physical or
neo-speculative or alchemical language. What is that principle that resists the second law? What is it that we have?
Well, we could talk about that. Bergson's Elan Vital or Paracelsus's idea of the archaeus, the internal subtle fire of the universe that is essentially what we call energy.
Yeah.
We could talk about life as a principle rather than just as an accident.
Right.
All these things would be adequate ways of looking at it. One doesn't want to be doctrinaire about it.
No. But there also seems to be something about the imagination, something that's actually been running through the whole conversation. Earlier you talked about the ambivalence of images, that there's a tendency to reduce experiences to images that we can process, and those images have to have their own kind of often insidious points to them, but there's also a counter magic of a more robust imagination, and it seems like part of what the Hermetic equation is, part of what Hermeticism can bring to something like the ecology movement, is a different way of relating to the imagination as a site of real encounters, of real experiences. So, how do you see the imagination?
Well, my ideas about imagination, of course, are derived from, in part anyway, and largely from Henri Corbin, whom I studied with in Iran, who coined the term imaginal, as in the mundus imaginalis, the imaginal world. This is the world between, in a metaphysical sense, it's the world between the material world and the spiritual world, where the spirit manifests as images and material explains itself to itself through images. So you could say it's the angelic realm, the messenger realm between the high and the low, between the above and below in Hermetic terms. These are not to be taken as value judgments. When you say high and low, you're not talking about value necessarily. You're talking about the fact that there is a mental sphere. There is an imaginal sphere. It's real. We experience it all the time, every day. There's no point in saying it's illusory. It's as real as it needs to be. And the same goes for the material world. It's as real as it needs to be. And it's in the meeting of these terms, the angelic experience of the meeting of these terms, that you would be able to revalue values, as Nietzsche put it, to give value back to value. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I want to think about this particularly in the ecological context that's on people's minds so much. It's so obvious that the quote unquote environment is breaking down and feeding back and manifesting our deep fears, which itself is an imaginal experience. I mean, the sense of an environmental crisis is also an event in the imagination that people are very much responding to, and I think often very ignorantly in terms of understanding how the imagination
neurotically
operates. Neurotically, great term.
If you wanted to dig up old Sigmund again.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair one. So how would you see, or how do you see, whether in the aspects of the environmental movement now, or in how ecology is functioning in people's minds and imaginations, where do you see points where that more robust sense of the imagination is making it a mark, is opening up possibilities?
Wow, that's a hard question. I mean, my friends just went up to Albany to protest against fracking. I couldn't go out because I can't do this kind of thing anymore. I'm too old. My heart went with them, but, I heard that basically there was a lot of flax from the solar industry business talking about how marvelous things are going to be because of solar and wind power. And I think this is ludicrous. This is just capitalism looking for another techno fix. And green capitalism is the worst possible enemy for getting anything actually done on this level. And of course capitalism is going to invest in solar and wind power. It's running out of oil. Hey, hello. This is the economy we're talking about. These people are just trying to save capitalism's ass again. And how are they doing it? They're trying to enlist all the sincere people who love the color green. So you call anything green and people go for it. And it's natural that they do because it's nature. you know, and we love nature. We don't know why exactly, but we do. If you're a hermeticist, you know why you love nature. But most people, it's just a vague general emotion. And so they can be manipulated by these evil bastards. Sorry to say it.
It's a very interesting and difficult problem that you know, inside, you know, as you know, that the environmental movement in the modern West has, you know, long had a, you know, a kind of spiritual undercurrent, whether it was, you know, hippie fantasies or people, you know, believing this one planetary mind or a Gaian spirit or the goddess energy. And these things have been kind of, you know, partly what motivates people, what gets people out on the streets, what gets people activated, is that there's some sense that there's something sacred in nature. And
right.
at the same time now, and not even just from, you know, cutthroat capitalist people, but from very, you know, earnest, intelligent, you know, trying to really grapple with the situation, people are like, you know, that religious stuff, the religious dimension of ecology, you know, that's what we have to get beyond. We have to get beyond this enchanted idea of nature.
If you use the word religion, then you're raising a problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Because in fact, religions historically have been largely to blame for the last 6,000 years. What is religion per se, in my mind, is what happens when the state appears and tries to monopolize the effective spiritual techniques that shamanism basically distributed equally amongst the tribe.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. I mean,
in other words, when you seize that and take it on behalf of a king priest class, the first thing you do is hide it from the people so they can no longer have effective spiritual techniques. And then you deny that they even exist. And so in monotheism, we've got to the point where they say, well, there's no beatific vision in this lifetime. You have to die and go to heaven. You know, you cannot see God in the world because God is not in the world effectively. I mean, you know, theologically, they would argue with this, but in effect, this is what they're actually saying. And as a result, there's a split, a schizophrenic or neurotic split between the self and nature. And that has to be overcome homeopathically. You know, you need a dose of the very poison that's killing you, but in a homeopathic sense. You know, poisons that don't kill you are intoxicants. They're psychedelic.
Yeah.
So we need a science of poisons, as Dale Pendel is always saying.
Absolutely. Well, we have just a few moments here, and I just was sort of curious where. Is it in nature, or is it in your study of the history of the human spirit that you find that you take the most, active sort of? I don't want to say solace, but just where you recharge your own hermetic batteries.
Is
it in your own work as a writer, historian? Thinking?
Nature or culture? Huh?
I'm just kind of curious.
Well, I have to say, at least ideally, both, of course. maybe if you know me personally, you know, perhaps I'm more bookish than natural. I'm not exactly. I can't grow beans. You know, I'm terrible when it actually comes.
We're going to have to end it on that note there, Peter. Thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
All right. Well, it was good talk.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
So from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.